across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Really good to have you here on another muggy day in London town, but they tell me the sunshine is coming soon, and the month of August may end quite well in the United Kingdom. Let's see if that happens, because time is getting short now. The summer is running out. Thank you very much for all of your emails. You can communicate with me through the website, theunexplained.tv. Thanks to Adam for maintaining the website and keeping the shows cranking out to you. Couldn't do any of it without Adam. If I sound slightly different at the moment, it's because I'm doing this on about 3 hours sleep. I got home from the TV show about 1 o'clock this morning, got to bed by three, then couldn't sleep. That's what I'm used to doing this. Over many years working in news, the number of days that I got up to bring news to London after no sleep, well, I would lose count of those if I tried to start counting them. Now, very, very important news, and this is the first time I'm talking about this. Many of you have been asking me about this for months and months, and now here is the answer. Yes, we are doing an Unexplained cruise this year. It will be the Unexplained Live 2. It is with Mirella again, who provided a superb experience in the Mediterranean last year. You loved it. So I would dearly like you to be part of this one. We have a remarkable collection of speakers this year. I will be able to very soon reveal full details of that. And we are going to somewhere fantastic at the best possible time of year to do it. That's intrigued you, hasn't it? So it's an experience not to be missed. The cruise and the holiday provided by Mirella, and the hosting of the events provided by me. So I will be there introducing you to each of the guests. It'll be your chance to ask them the questions that you've always wanted to ask them, and also get books signed and just interact with them in a way that you couldn't anywhere else. You go to a theatre, you see the presentation, and everybody goes away. On a ship, you're all together. That's one of the great experiences of doing this in a cruise setting. And as you know, I was not a cruise convert until I actually did this last year. And I was blown away by the experience, by the level of service, by the beauty of the surroundings we found ourselves in, and by the fact that if I needed anything 24/7, it was there for me. All I had to do was ask. And that was the experience that people were telling me about every day when I met them in the cafeteria over breakfast, or I met them over dinner in the evenings, or I met them on the various trips, you know, at ports of call. Without exception, 100%, everybody I spoke with, and people were coming up to me, absolutely loved it, and so did I. So you will not be disappointed. I will be able to tell you more soon about this, but one thing I can tell you is one of the guests is Malcolm Robinson. He is, of course, investigator and author. His latest book is called Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain, Volume 4. In his time, he's written about ghosts and poltergeists, UFOs, cases like the Socky poltergeist, the UFO cluster at Bonnybridge in Scotland, and so many other things that he has done, including the Loch Ness Monster, which is in the news again now. So the guest on this edition of The Unexplained, and also one of the speakers who will be there for you on The Unexplained Live Cruise, which will be in October, at the end of October. It will begin third week of. I will tell you more about that as soon as I can, which will be very soon. He will be one of the guests, but also, just going back to the cruise for a moment, we will have one incredibly special guest who will be joining us at one of the ports of call. And this person is not doing anything like this anywhere else, as far as I know. This is something that might well make headlines. So that's one reason of so many reasons for being part of the cruise. Back to Malcolm Robinson, though. His new book is just out. I'm holding it in my hand right here. How many pages is it? It's 400 and more than 450 pages. And it's from Philip Mantle's Flying Disc Press. Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain, Volume 4, with a ghostly figure on the front page. And a picture of Malcolm on the back. I think I've said everything that I need to say now. If you want to email me about anything, then please go to my website, theunexplained.tv. Follow the link and send me an email from there. If you've made a donation to this show, thank you very, very much for doing that. Very, very kind of you, and vital, especially at these straitened times, that you do that, or at least consider doing it if you can. More details, as I say, about the cruise coming soon. There'll be a special podcast and a special micro website, like last year, which will have all the details of the booking. You will have a booking code to use, a special booking code for fans of The Unexplained. So all of those things, biographies of the guests and details of all of the ports of call and all of the things that you need to know about this particular location, let's put it that way, for the cruise, they will be there at a special micro website that I will also be unveiling soon. Intrigued, eh? I bet you are. Okay, let's get to Malcolm Robinson now. Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain, Volume 4. Malcolm, thank you very much for coming on the show again.
It's a pleasure, Howard.
And of course, we've got another reason to celebrate, because I've just informed the world that you're going to be part of the Unexplained Live 2, the second cruise that we're doing at the moment. And it's only going to be for a period of a week or so. I can't say exactly, and neither can you, where it's going to. But I think we can concur and tease people even more by saying, Malcolm, we're going to some amazing places, aren't we?
Oh, for sure, we really are, and it's a wonderful opportunity for me to come on board and speak about some wonderful paranormal and ufological cases. So it's a great opportunity. Yes, looking forward.
And of course, it's always a chance for people, and I found it was very important last time in the Mediterranean to come and meet you and talk with you. And I find the cruise setting is much more informal, much more relaxed, and makes it much more easier to do.
Absolutely, and this is where I get a lot of my stories, to be honest with you, Howard, because people will approach me after a lecture and they'll say, you know, I've never told my husband about these stories, these strange stuff that's happened to me, but I'm going to speak to you. And it's great because it provides them an opportunity to meet people like myself and the other guest speakers on the cruise and just unfold, share those stories, give those stories. Because people always don't know where to turn to. You know, if you've had a strange paranormal happening thing in your life, you really don't know who to turn to, and will you get made a fool of by the media? Who do you go to? So in this environment where we can provide these paranormal stories on a cruise ship and a good audience, it lets them come to us and relay their stories.
Yeah, and I found people were very, very happy with that aspect of it. But there is so much about it that's going to be amazing. And you and I both know that there is one person coming on who has, I think we can say this person has featured in a movie, who is going to be visiting the ship on one of the days and doing a special presentation, which is going to be the stuff that headlines are made of. So I'm very, very excited, even though at the moment I can't say who it is and what it is. But there you go. Yeah. My hands are tied. My lips are sealed. Loch Ness Monster is in the news. You've written about and researched the Loch Ness Monster. They're doing, at the end of August, I think it's the 26th and 27th, they're doing a great big Loch Ness Monster hunt, or I think it's more of a vigil than anything else. But so far, the people behind it, who are Loch Ness Exploration and the Loch Ness Monster Centre there, the Loch Ness Monster or Loch Ness Exploration people tell me that so far, and it's probably increased by now, they've had like 175 volunteers. So this is going to be a big one.
Yeah, certainly it's a great opportunity to bring people, like-minded people together with the love of Loch Ness and what inhabits it, to sit around the shores of the loch with the binoculars and really scan the lochs in hopes of a sighting. I mean, it obviously is done on a day-to-day basis anyway with the various tourists coming over from Japan, but this is a serious venture. This is put on by some friends that I know, and they're really pushing the boat out. They really want, you know, people who really will sit and take the time to scan the loch at all hours of the day and including at night as well. And I just think it's one of these things that it's going to enhance the profile of Loch Ness. And in point of fact, Howard, SPI, that's my society, Strange Phenomena Investigations, we have our own planned Loch Ness investigation for 2024, which is not going to be surface-based, it's going to be underwater. We have a ship involved, we have the sonar, etc., and it's a wee bit under wraps, just like this cruise we were speaking about earlier. So you are the first journalist ever to know about this project, and this is going to be big, big news next year for 2024.
That's astonishing. How do you put together something like that? I don't want you to give me the specifics, but, you know, just in general terms, how do you put something like that together?
Well, admittedly, it's all going to come through sponsorship. You know, we're looking for some of the big boys, be it a whiskey distiller or someone from Japan to put the money up, etc. Because let's be honest, without that, you can't get the project underway. But the aims of the project is to, and it may sound a wee bit silly to some of your listeners, but the aims of the project is to entice whatever is in Loch Ness towards, well, we'll be descending into the depths of Loch Ness, a big black box, probably about 6 feet wide, 6 feet width, etc., with holes in it. And inside that will be a fish puree, which is constantly turning out this through the holes in this big box. It will act as an attractant. On the corners of this box will be GoPro cameras and also strong lights. We also have a small ROV submersible, which will be in the area as well. So this is basically to entice anything large towards this, you know. And we'll be at various parts of the loch, at Invermorriston, Drumnadrochit, Foyers, Fort Augustus. We'll be there for probably about 2.5 weeks, and we'll be using the best sophisticated sonar as well, because as we know, it's sonar for me, and I've said it on your show before, is probably the best evidence to suggest that there's something in excess of 10 to 15 feet in Loch Ness. As to what it is, I probably come around to possibly thinking it's a large mutated eel. Not what believers want to accept, because everybody would love for it to be a prehistoric plesiosaur. But those creatures could not extend their neck, you know. And a lot of the sightings have been seen of a large neck, vertical, with a small kind of sheep-like head extending from the bowels of Loch Ness through the surface and descending again. So it's possibly a large mutated eel. I could be wrong, of course. But yes, we're quite excited about this project. It's a big, big ship we've got, with all the sophisticated equipment on board as well.
How do you... This is a really dumb question, but you know I'm an expert in those. How do you know what to put in the puree of attractant food for Nessie?
Yes, we have one of the guys who is going to be joining us on this trip is a marine biologist, and he's worked in the fisheries department as well. He's really, really clued up, and he knows all the kind of nutrients and fish puree kind of stuff to use. You have to get it authorised, believe it or not. So you don't want to put something in the loch that's going to decimate, for want of a better word, the fish population. So it has to be agreed, excuse me, by the fisheries board. And so that's his domain, I'm afraid. So he knows what he's talking about.
Very exciting, though. And, you know, it puts the Loch Ness Monster, that area, in the headlines. I have to say, I do get emails from sceptics who say the Loch Ness Monster doesn't exist, it never has existed, it's only there for the tourist industry. By going to the lengths that you've gone, you clearly don't believe that.
No, we just want to prove what's in there. So we're going into its domain. You know, we believe surface photography, it's not the greatest, because you can manipulate, you can, you know, falsify photographs. A lot of people come to Loch Ness, they're only there for a few hours visiting, and they think they see something on Loch Ness, and it's not. Loch Ness, the moods of Loch Ness changes quite dramatically with the winds, pools of water, the blackness, the black patches on the loch, etc. And you have a lot of waterfowl, you have otters and seals. So if you can imagine a seal's head poking up to somebody from Japan, they may think that's a Nessie or something like that. But there's something there. We just want to get underwater and try and find out what it is. We're not, I'll be honest with you, we're not expecting to probably capture anything like I did in 1994 on a previous show that I did with Howard. Steven Spielberg was going to put up the money to help me build this cage, something similar to what we were doing in 2024. Sadly, that fell through. But, you know, it's just something that we need to do. We need to prove this. As far as publicity, you mentioned a moment ago, when you look at Elvis Presley Boulevard in Memphis, Tennessee, you've got all these wee rocking wee little Elvises gyrating and stuff. So, yes, of course you're going to get people to make money out of it. There is a cottage industry around Loch Ness, you know, more so at Drumnadrochit and Fort Augustus. They'll sell model Nessies, and that's fine. You'll get that anywhere. And it's just part of the enigma that is Loch Ness.
It is. And, you know, Stratford-on-Avon capitalises on the link with William Shakespeare. There are parts of this country that have ties to former prime ministers or famous battles that occurred there. So if you have one of the greatest legends of the world based in your community, then go for it, is what I say. I don't think that's a problem at all. But you clearly don't think that this is a seal or something like that. And I think, and people have said to me, it's a big seal. A seal or a group of seals would probably come and check you out. They're quite sociable. They've been described as the dogs of the sea. But this creature that's been photographed and monitored for so many years is elusive. That's the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And the vast majority of the photographs which claim to show Nessie are not Nessie at all. You know, they've been hoaxed. The famous surgeon's photograph, for instance, we now know that that's been hoaxed. And so are a number of other photographs as well. One of the chapters in my book on the monsters of Loch Ness was all about a guy called Frank Serrell, who came up to Loch Ness from England, and he stayed for a good number of years, and he took sensational photographs of Nessie, which it turned out to be nothing of the sort. It was just he had cut round dinosaurs and put it into the frame of the photograph, and they wouldn't allow anybody near his negatives, etc. You know, and I've interviewed Frank, and he's a wonderful, warm character. Sadly, no longer with us, but his photographs went all over the world of showing creatures above the surface of Loch Ness, his big humped body, the long snaking neck, etc. I mean, at the time, 1972 to probably 75, they were sensational. And of course, let's not forget the work that Dr. Robert Rhines did, the Academy of Applied Science, again back in 72 and 74, sorry. They came over from America with some of the best equipment, and they managed to get some incredible underwater photographs of what appears to be Nessie. So again, for our society next year, the search must go underwater, not above it.
I think that's so exciting, and thank you very much for telling me first. So we've had two exclusives on this show, two revelations, one that, and the other one, the cruise, the full details of which we can't give quite yet, but you're going to be part of that. One quick question, and then we'll get into the book, I promise. I was speaking to a man on my TV show last night, the great Marcus Allen from Nexus Magazine, about crop circles. I don't know whether you've ever dealt with these, but apparently crop circles are still happening in August 2023, even though the media is not reporting them, and they appear to be getting more complex.
Yes, crop circles. Anybody who knows me and has come to my lectures know full well that I don't put a great deal of stock on crop circles. The vast majority, if not them all, for me are man-made. And the reason I say that, Howard, is I know a lot of people who make them. They're so easy to make with the night vision goggles, the stomping boards. You're talking about not the normal concentric circles. You're talking about insectograms, all these different boxes and lead-offs from... They look splendid. They look fantastic.
Well, some of them, the current ones, sorry to jump in, but they are of amazing complexity. Now, I have to say that I was useless at art. Very good at photography. I could only draw stick figures in art. I couldn't do it. You're saying that some of these incredibly complex formations in Wiltshire and Hampshire and other places, as far as you would surmise, are probably human-made.
Well, I know they are. I know they're human-made. And they try the Wiltshire crop circle makers try to outdo other counties. You know, they try to see who makes the best crop circle and get it into the newspapers. Having said that, one chap that used to make crop circles, Matthew Williams, a lovely guy, he told me that when he and his colleagues were making these crop circles in the fields of Wiltshire, suddenly they would see these balls of light descend from the sky and weave in and out of their crop circle formation 20, 30, 40 yards away. And that bamboozled him. On other occasions, they've seen a tall, shadowy figure standing at the edge of the crop field. And they're surmising, oh dear, you know, that must be the farmer. I think we've been rumbled. So they walk towards this figure, and the figure just melts away. So even the guys that make the crop circles have said there is still a phenomena attached to these wonderful circles.
Wow, never heard that before. So it's not possibly them communicating with us. It might be us communicating with them, whoever they are.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, you could have other guests on the show who say that the crop circles are made by aliens, etc. But certainly, I don't believe so.
Let's dive into the book then. This is volume four. I mean, this book is 450-odd pages, absolutely packed. Just talk to me about the concept.
Well, the concept of the Paranormal Case Files is effectively to try and impress upon my readers that these stories come from all over Great Britain, and they each have a story to tell. You know, people who, like I said earlier, have unloaded these stories to me. They needed to get these stories out. People who see ghosts, people who have had premonitions, UFO sightings. There's a whole range of things that's in this book, but it's primarily to get this information out because, as I've always said, it's no good me collecting all these wonderful stories and filing them away in a filing cabinet. They've got to get into book form. And if people say, oh, I don't believe that, that's absolutely fine, Howard, because you and I know we're both involved in the paranormal. We love this subject dearly. Yes, we know there's a lot of shenanigans out there. Yes, there's a lot of falsities. Of course there are. But once you brush that aside, you're left looking at some marvellous, marvellous tales. And I've interviewed a number of people for this book. It just blew me away. And I just knew that these stories had to go in there. And I needed to share these wonderful stories with the readers, yeah. And, of course, your good self.
Now, you give me a steer on this, because I've only skipped and flipped through this book. However, I've come up with some, and I know that there are some that you want to talk about. So I'll give you the page references, if that helps. First of all, I picked some reaction that you got in connection with your work on the Sochi poltergeist, which we've talked about on this podcast before. And this is page 46, Christian's story. And this is somebody, if I've got this right, who communicated with you and told you their experiences in Scotland. This person moved house many times because of all the hauntings.
Yeah, the Christian, it's actually a female. Yes, by the name of Christian. Now, my goodness me, where do you start? This poor, poor lady has been plagued by many hauntings, poltergeist effects, and not just in one house, but numerous houses which she lived in. She thought that by moving house, you know, that would be it, the ghost would stay in the previous property. Sadly, that was not the case. It moved with her all over the place. And there were so many typical hauntings, Howard. You know, there were things falling off the shelf. She was getting poked in the body. She was getting scratched. She saw shadowy figures appear in various parts of the home. It was really distressing. And that was, again, that was a story that had to go in the book, because there'll be people who read this book, maybe not just necessarily this story, but other stories, and they'll say, you know what? That has happened to me. And we need to find out how many of these type of stories are here in the British Isles, because clearly there's something there. We're talking, obviously, about the continuity after physical material death. I mean, I'm a spiritualist. As you know, I've been on your show. I started off when I was young, sceptical. Totally, totally, totally sceptical. But as I progressed through the years and spent many nights in haunted houses, I've been slapped by nothing, my hair pulled by nothing. When those things happen to yourself, that's when you come off the sceptical fence. And this poor lady, as I say, she's moved around houses, and she had to tell me what had happened to her. She was getting abuse from her neighbours. Nobody believed her. Her family didn't believe her. She had a terrible, terrible time. And unfortunately, you know, these things happen. These things happen. They are, sadly, spirits that won't leave people alone. In the Sochi poltergeist, for instance, the spirit or the poltergeist that followed the girl from Ireland to Scotland also followed her down to England. So, I mean, sometimes, thankfully not all the time, there is this what we call a kind of spirit attachment, which thankfully you can get rid of.
So you think it's more, because we know that, for example, you know, the Enfield poltergeist, but other poltergeist cases, they've been very much about the people who were the ones who were the subject of the poltergeist. In other words, it appeared to have a great deal to do with them. But you think that there is still a big element, in this case of Christian and other cases like it, of something external zeroing in on something to do with the person.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a very, very nasty spirit that had attached itself to that lady, and also the little girl in the Socky Poltergeist case as well. And you know, it's not a nice thing. And in the South Shields Poltergeist, for instance, so incredible case. And for me, the South Shields Poltergeist near Newcastle was far, far bigger than the Enfield case for me personally, in regards to what happened. And we're now getting back to what I mentioned earlier, that it can be nasty. And what I mean by that is the gentleman who stayed in this house suddenly said that his back, it was burning. And one of the researchers lifted up his shirt and you could see big scratch marks, finger marks, fresh, coming streaking down his back. They weren't 2 or 3 days old. These were fresh and they were being made right in front of the investigator's eyes. Skeptics might say it's some form of stigmata or something, you know, the bleeding from the palms and from the head. But if it's a medical condition, wow, you know, that's equally worthy of study. But that was part and parcel of them, the people in that house being assaulted by this nasty spirit.
Really chilling. And, you know, it makes most of us think, thank God we're not assaulted and assailed by something of this character. But what a story. You talked about ghosts in various locations. You talk about them in this book. One of them, I have to talk with you about. It's page 67, and there's a background to it. I remember seeing, when I was a kid, a documentary on BBC television in the UK. Michael Palin, one of the Monty Python people, it was, I think, his first sort of travelogue. He went on a train journey to the Kyle of Lochalsh. And I always, ever since seeing, still haven't done it, I promised myself that I would, if it's still running, take the train to Kyle of Lochalsh one of these days and just enjoy the peace up there. But apparently the Kyle of Lochalsh hotel has a ghost. And this is a pretty spectacular case. The story is of somebody who worked there, one of the stories, apparently had to do like a check down the corridors in the middle of the night. And came across face to face something extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, it, as if he saw people from the olden days, you know, like not so much prehistoric man, maybe a few hundred years later, but he saw this man and this woman staring at him. They had small dark eyes, they had this terrible grin, and they appeared quite unfriendly, you know. And they had some kind of necklace around its neck. It was wearing this weird kind of necklace as well. But it wasn't just that. He had a number of strange experiences in that hotel during the course of the time that he was there. And it was mostly of seeing this man and woman from olden times. I'm really talking olden times here. And apparently this is still ongoing even today, because I was speaking to someone recently who was at the Kyle Lochalsh Hotel, and they said, yeah, I saw something. I just saw it in the corner of my eye, but it was one figure, a hazy figure, and he didn't know that the place was haunted. And yeah, it's just great to get these stories out in the books.
Yep, a chilling story, and a place that I think I would like to visit, and I would love to meet the ghost, because what we have to say is that a lot of people get very scared of ghosts, and in the main, in most stories, nobody is ever hurt by a ghost.
Well, yeah, by a ghost.
Not a poltergeist.
A poltergeist is certainly different. That can be nasty. But yes, you're correct. With a ghost, and you have a number of variations of ghosts, of course you do. You have the classic transparent ghosts you can see through, but you also get solid appearing ghosts. And people have seen people walking down the street and going, wait a minute, that's Harry. He died last week, and yet he appears solid, you know. And also you get anniversary ghosts, of a ghost that maybe walked down a corridor in a stately home only on July 27th, for instance. And so there's all these variations of ghosts, and also the ghosts which appear in buildings. It may be like some form of magnetic energy. You know, there's a case in Wales, there's a haunted pub, and is it Kenfig? I think it is, Kenfig. And the proprietor locked the pub up at one night, and he left. And as he was walking away, He could hear merriment, voices, the clinking of glasses, an old organ playing. He went, wait a minute, I've just locked up. There's nobody in there. And this happened several times. But to cut a long story short, these electrical engineers went up and they had a quite an interesting concept idea. What they did is they got microphone, some kind of sensors, and put it into the very fabric. It was an old stone building, Howard, you know, so they put the microphones into the very fabric of it, pressed play and record, and exited the building. On returning the following day, they played the sounds, and by God, you could hear the talking, the clinking of glasses, an old organ which used to be in that pub about 50 to 70 years ago. So basically what we're saying here with this type of ghost, it's like, if you like, an old VHS recorder. It recorded your pictures and your sound. And if you went over it and over it again, recording more programs, it would diminish, it would get weaker, the signal would get weaker. So some, and we don't know why, we don't know the mechanism, but it's a case where something can be stored in the very fabric of old buildings and can be heard by either sensitive people. If you like, some of your listeners may have went to see a family relation, they've knocked on the door, they get welcomed in, but they know. They know straight away that there's an atmosphere in the room. And then they find out later that whilst these people put a nice smile on their face at the door, they had been arguing, you know, maybe half an hour beforehand, so they can still experience something's changed in the air. So when we talk about ghosts and spirits, it's not so cut and dried. But for me as a spiritualist, I've seen so much evidence over the years, spent so many nights in haunted houses, that the evidence for me is absolutely overwhelming that each and every one of us will survive the grave and live, albeit in a different environment. Sounds Hollywood, but that's what I've come to accept.
And yet, we can't summon these things up at random and at will. My father's, it would have been his 100th birthday, quite recently, if he'd been with us. And, you know, I remembered him on that date. And my father and his father before him were very into all of this. Even though my father was a policeman, he was the original Liverpool good cop. Everybody loved him. His dad read teacups. You know, which was something that people did to give them sort of psychic readings. And there were always stories around my dad and his dad to do with things they'd experienced. My father was in the army before he joined the police, and he had ghostly experiences in the army. So I thought, to cut a long story short, that if ever my dad, who was very close to me, loved me as much as he did when I was... He loved me as much when I was 40 as he did when I was 4. You know, it never changed. He was a wonderful, wonderful man, both my parents. I miss them terribly. But on this date, I thought of him and I thought, Dad, if ever you're going to contact me, this has to be the time. And there was nothing. So yeah. None of this works at random, does it?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. You know, and I mean, I've lost my brother to spirit, and many a times I've asked him to come forward and just prove move an object or move something in the room or whatever, and it hasn't happened. So there must be a mechanism where it doesn't always happen to every person that's passed over. Maybe they go further towards the light, whatever. But clearly there is a mechanism there. The only way to a degree that you're going to get that communication is by going along to a very, very good psychic. Somebody you can trust, and it's not cold reading or body language. Somebody, and only you will know yourself, Howard. If you sat in front of a psychic and she tells you things about your father, wee personal things that only she could know, then either it's some form of she's reading your mind, which is again is fantastic, or she really is providing that communication from your father. But you're right, you can't do it at the drop of your hat. You can't call forward Auntie Agnes and Uncle Harry, but if you went to some good psychics, you're probably going to get a good reading. Yeah.
Page 71 of the book. An underwater ghost, I love this one, at an aquarium, great big aquarium in Hull, Humberside. Now, this photograph, you probably get sent loads of photographs. I get sent some. And some of them, it's pretty clear to see that it's a camera artifact or it's the reflection of somebody caught by the lens. Yeah. It isn't what they think it is. This is a weird one. And the person who took the picture, I think, tried to recreate it and couldn't. This is a weird head taken actually at the aquarium. I think the aquarium's got these tunnels that you can walk under, through, and then virtually walk through the water. I think that's how it is. But there's, you got the photograph in the book. This strange, very detailed head that appears from nowhere in the photograph. Amazing.
Yes, yeah, it's kind of amazing. But even though it looks amazing, I think I mentioned in the book that we have to be very, very careful when being sent any alleged ghostly photograph, because it could be what's known as simulacrum or pareidolia. And what that effectively means is, if you look into the sky, you may see a cloud in the shape of a face, because your brain is hardwired to make sense out of nonsense. So a lot of photographs that's submitted to SPI, we believe, are just pareidolia. You know, you can just see faces in about anything. Now, admittedly, this is a very, very clear face for sure. And it was taken, as you said, in this aquarium. It's a place called The Deep in Hull. And it's Europe's deepest viewing tunnel. I think it's about 30 feet long. So she took this photograph, and all you see is this face. And she has tried to recreate it, but with little success. Now, the gentleman who investigated this case is a nice guy called Mike Covell, and he believes that this is a genuine article as well. So it's a funny one, because, you know, some people say you never, ever get a good photograph of a ghost. Well, here we have one. Is it a reflection? Is it someone standing off centre of the camera and somehow impregnated into the very fabric of that aquarium glass? Is it simulacrum? If it was taken a few seconds later, would the lines behind that photograph not have converged to look like a face? The only thing we can say is that allegedly is haunted. The building is meant to be haunted. So is it? Are we talking a ghost here? Who knows?
Well, the face, and I'm looking at it now, it looks eerie. I think it's a male. The hair is very well defined. The eyebrows and eyes are incredibly well defined. There's a nose with nostrils, a mouth with two clear lips, and a very detailed ear. So that is definitely a head. That is definitely a face and head on that picture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I'm on the cruise that we spoke about at the top of the show, one of the talks I'll be giving will be the best ghostly photographs that I've researched over 40-odd years. So I'll be providing an opportunity to put these up on a big screen, after which I'll be giving the audience my own personal ghostly experiences. And boy, there have been a few.
And of course, people will get the chance, which they did with me on the last cruise, to come up at the end of it. Or they'd meet me over breakfast. That's the lovely thing about doing this. You go for breakfast, sir, and people come up to you. And once you've been doing it for 2 days, you're a family. And people come up and say, you know, you talked about that thing. Well, this happened to me. So I think you're going to get another book's worth out of the cruise, to be honest.
I certainly hope so.
I loved page 91, the East Kilbride, this is 1994, the East Kilbride ghost dog. This, I think, is a person who went to sleep. They'd lost their dog a year before and was woken by the dog, seemingly.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many cases to do with spirit animals. And let's be honest here, Howard, you know, some people love their animals more than their fellow human beings. And not just that story, but I have another story in the book as well about the ghostly dog of Alien Bill. Now, he's a chap from York, lovely guy. He takes some incredible paranormal photographs. Well, they had a dog called Rocky. It was half Chihuahua and half King Charles Spaniel, which probably about the size of a terrier. They loved that dog, just like we all love our pets, you know. And sadly, you know, it got older, it passed away. Now, a few days later, Bill was looking out into the back garden, and he saw Rocky, the wee dog, as clear as day, running around the flowers, jumping about, wagging its tail. And not just that, over the weeks that followed, he'd be sitting on the settee watching the television, and bang, he felt a pressure coming down on his legs. He could hear scratching noises on some of the furniture, and he looked down, nothing to be seen. On one occasion, he was coming down the stairs, and there, sitting at the foot of the stairs, was his wee dog, Rocky, with its head tilted to one side as if to say, are we going out for a walk? And as he walked down, as he walked down the he reached the bottom stair, it just disappeared. His wife, Vic, has experienced it as well. She saw it as well. They've been lying in bed together and the bed depresses down as if something's jumped up on that. So it's great that it brings a lot of comfort to a lot of people when their animals pass over and they can experience it again. But like getting back to my brother and your father, you can't. It doesn't happen to everybody, Howard, you know. People might say, well, I love my pet and I haven't seen it. There is this mechanism where it doesn't always happen. But when we hear these wonderful stories from, you know, Bill Rourke and Vic, well, it's just great. It just backs up the other stories worldwide.
And you also say, and this isn't talked about very much, that we mustn't forget that objects, things that we create, ships and planes and other things, can also be ghosts. I find that interesting, a bit chilling, like the sort of phantom ship idea or the phantom plane.
You know, it sounds preposterous. It sounds laughable. But yes, people have seen ghostly aircraft in the sky. They've been at Brooklyn's old racetrack and they've heard the rumble and the sound of old racing cars going around the track. And they've seen ghostly trams, etc. And it makes you wonder, why is this? Is this getting back to what I said earlier about this some kind of magnetic recording in the area that only some sensitive people can pick up on? I think I've said on your show before, you could have six people in a haunted room and only three will see this ghost. The other three won't see it. Is it because they're not tuned in, so to speak? They're not just like one of the old radio sets before DAB, where you turn the dial from BBC Radio 1, you're turning it to reach Radio 2. So you're going in between frequencies and then suddenly, bang, you've caught that frequency. So it's my belief that there's a number, a good number, of gifted people here, and not just in the UK, but the world over, who are sensitive, who have this wonderful ability to tune into psychics. And this is why when we go on ghostly investigations, whilst we may take along, you know, some bits of gizmo, pieces of equipment, the best equipment you can have is someone you trust, a gifted psychic medium, who will then tell you who is behind these disturbances in this family home, and try, with the householder's permission, to move them on. And that's the beauty of it.
Mm-hmm. I think I've told you before that I went through a period in my 20s when I psychic shopped, and I went to see many, many people, and a lot of them, maybe it was the wrong day for them, maybe there wasn't the simpatico, whatever it might be between the two of us, were way off beam. I remember being told, actually quite recently, not in that particular raft of visitations, but I remember being told by one psychic, of course, your mother was a very tall woman, wasn't she? My mother wasn't. I think my mother was 5'4" or 5'2".
Oh,
so pretty wrong about that. Please tell me, if you don't mind, page 327. I love this. Never heard of it before now. The Busby Stoop Chair. This is a chair cursed, apparently, by a murderer that keeps on, or kept on, claiming victims.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bizarre one, you know, and I just love putting in bizarre stories in my book. Basically, I sent us round this chap called Thomas Busby, and he enjoyed the odd drink or two, shall we say. And it's one of these guys who had a regular seat in his favourite pub, and that was his seat. You know, you do not want to sit in a seat or strange things could happen. Now, he was a petty thief and he got into a fight with someone who tried to sit in his chair, and Thomas Busby actually murdered the guy. So long story short, when he was going to the gallows, he said that anybody who sits in his chair, misfortune will befall him. And that's what happened. Over the course of a number of years, strange things transpired. For instance, one such death was this cleaner was approaching this chair and she knocked into it and she suddenly passed away.
Oh,
you had a chimney sweep who fell off the roof to his death. You had a number of deaths associated with this chair. Anybody who sat in this chair would die of mysterious circumstances. Now, of course, the sceptics would say, well, by chance, people are going to die anyway. But when you look at the statistics with this particular case, it's pretty amazing. It got so bad that they actually had to put the chair up on the ceiling because you had everybody wanting to sit in it, you know.
Oh, God. Not me.
And it was actually sent to a museum, I think it was in Thrissk, where it's now behind a safety glass or something. But so this chair, yeah, you get haunted chairs, people who love chairs, and this is the same thing. You could walk into a stately home and some people have said, well, I see a man sitting in that chair, and that chair's maybe hundreds of years old. Again, it's getting back to perception. It's quite an interesting story, yeah.
Well, no, it is. I'm surprised that this thing was not destroyed along the way, but I wouldn't want to be the person who destroyed it.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I'm one of these researchers who wanted to sit in that chair.
Did you really?
I did, yes, honestly. And same with the haunted objects and haunted dolls. A lot of these so-called haunted dolls are nothing of the sort. They're advertised on eBay or what have you, and it's just old dolls that people want to make money out of. So for any listeners, be very, very wary of buying so-called haunted dolls. Now, I'm not saying you don't get that. We look at Annabelle the doll. There's so many. It's been made into movies,
Chucky,
and documentaries. Chucky, well, that's different. So, yeah, you've got all that. Be careful. But, I mean, with that gentleman, Bill Rourke, for York, I've got a couple of wonderful stories that, if we've got time, I'd like to share with yourself and your listeners.
Let's do it.
Yeah, I gave a lecture at the Freedom Centre in Hull in Yorkshire, England, so last year, 2022. And a good friend of mine, Bill Rourke, as I say, he's taken a lot of strange photographs with his camera. Now, he went into the gents' toilets, and as he was drying his hands, his right-hand side went really cold, more so at his ear, and he heard this gravelly voice next to his ear saying, "You all right, mate?" And he went, what? And nobody was there, Howard, and he checked to see if anybody was in anywhere in the gents' toilets. There were nobody was there. It wasn't until later that we heard that this place, the Freedom Centre, is heavily haunted. But it gets even more bizarre, because when he came back to the auditorium, there was a full day's of lectures happening there. And funnily enough, I was on the stage at the time. I was talking about the Socky Porter guy. So Bill Rourke went back to his seat. He was sitting next to his wife, Vic, and a lady called Kathy Cogliano from the United States that came over. Now, this is bizarre. This is totally bizarre. What they claim they saw was this. It was an arm from the fingertips of the hands just to the elbow. Just appeared near their knees. They're sitting down, and it started to float from right-hand side to the left. It looked like an old man's hand. You know, there were no rings on the fingers. They didn't see much in the way of veins. It was like dark material. It was to the end of the elbow, and it just got fuzzy at the end. It just floated in front of them, and then just slowly disappeared. Bill Rourke saw it. Kathy Cogliano saw it. Vic, who was there, didn't see it. What she saw was a ball of white light. But, this is why I love this subject so much, because it's so bizarre, you know.
And that sounds like a partially materialised figure.
It does, and part of my talks, and more so when I do the one on the ship, I'll be showing that some of these ghostly photographs are not just of figures. They can be of a hand, they can be of an elbow, you know. So as if it's, the spirit is just trying to materialise, but it can only do so much. But I've never really heard of this type of ghostly arm floating in front of people. And if any of the listeners out there has heard that, by all means, do get in touch.
You're also brave enough to address something that I've talked around on the TV show late at night. And I have to be conscious of the fact that the podcast is heard by all ages and sensibilities. But you deal with the subject of having intimate relationships with ghosts, so-called spectrophilia. Now, whenever I read about that, and once a year, twice a year, you get stories about this in the newspapers, I'm always more than sceptical. I always think it's more to do with the people believing that these things have happened to them than them actually happening. Do you believe that such a thing can occur?
Well, yeah, I mean, what we're talking about here, obviously, is some people call it incubi or succubi. And what that is, it's an evil spirit who allegedly has sexual relations with males and females. It does sound absolutely out there, you know, bizarre. There was a movie some years ago called The Entity, which was allegedly based on a true story of a woman being sexually molested by the spirit. Now, in all my years of researching the paranormal, I've only came across that once, and that was a case down in England where this lady claimed that she was lying in bed of a night and, you know, sexual things were happening to her. Obviously, you have to think, is this a medical condition? Is she looking for some people just to come into her life and give her a bit of attention? Of course you're going to think about that. And that's what we did as a research group. You know, we asked all the relevant questions. Are you on any medication that could cause you to hallucinate? You know, are you seeing your doctor regularly? And then just getting into the story. But she was traumatised, you know. She really, really was traumatised by it all. And I'll give you a quick, for instance, so we were there with an English psychic, and myself and my girlfriend at the time, we went outside to have a cigarette. So we're outside for about 5 minutes. We come back in, and I sits down on the settee. My girlfriend sits down in the settee. And this lady was sitting in the middle of the living room in a chair. And then suddenly, bang, hundreds of these tiny aquamarine bluey turquoise lights pervaded and floated all around her body. And I let out a big girly scream. I went, what? And my girlfriend shouted, can you see it as well? And this poor lady, she's sitting there, what are you looking at? What can you see? So I said to her psychic, you know, she said, well, what are you seeing, Malcolm? I said, I'm seeing these beautiful blue, aquamarine blue lights running all over her body, her shoulders, her head. What is it? And the psychic says, well, Malcolm, when you and your girlfriend were outside having a cigarette, I administered psychic healing on the lady because, as you know, she's very traumatised. And what you are seeing, Malcolm, is the remnants of this psychic healing. And honest to God, Howard, it was absolutely astonishing. How I wish you and your listeners could have seen this. Whilst it's a nice wee story over the radio, to be there and see that, wow, it was incredible.
Which brings me back to a story that I've told a couple of times, I think, over the years. But in my questing phase in my 20s, I remember, at the behest of my sister who gave me the details, going to a house in Acton in London. Old-fashioned house, Terrace Street, front room of this house. The woman, whose name I cannot remember, she tells me to stand in the middle of the room. I remember there was a fish tank in the room. I don't know why I remember this particular detail, but there was a fish tank in this room. And the lights are out, and she says, close your eyes, stand still. And she puts her hand, I must have been 25, puts her hand on my head, and I see a revolving white light like a halo. You remember the old TV show, The Saint? Templar, he'd say, you know, are you the saint? And Roger Moore would look up and a halo would appear. Exactly that was inside my closed eyes, revolving, spinning around my head, the brightest, piercing platinum light.
Yes, you possibly were trying to get some bad negativity. It maybe surrounded you at that time. Yeah, again, that's speculation on my part. But it may have been that. And so what you were seeing was some foundation of what she was doing to you. You saw it in your mind's eye. You saw this bright, you know, circular light, so to speak. So it possibly could be that. Yes, possibly.
Well, if anybody has an idea of what that might be, you can always contact me through the website, theunexplained.tv. You talk about premonitions. And one that we must never forget is one around the Abervan coal tip disaster, South Wales, 1966, a mountain of waste material from a mining operation that hadn't been properly supervised, slid down onto a school. The nation was traumatised when it learned that 116 children, 28 adults, I think it was, were killed in that. And there was a woman who had a precognitive dream about that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a number of premonitions prior to that. You know, this coal tip, this slurry just slid down over this school. But one of them was a 10-year-old girl. I think it was Errol Maya Jones. She had had a dream the night before, and in this dream, suddenly the school was missing. There was like a black thing covering it, she said, you know, and she didn't want to go to school that day. But sadly, her mother, you know, just thought it was a dream, and she went to school and she'd lost her life. So that was a premonition that was told to her mother, and it came true the day before. It's amazing the amount of premonitions we have. And I mentioned a few in the book. You know, we've got 9/11, people walking to work and just went, wait a minute, something's going to happen here. I'm not going to go in today. Now, the skeptic might say, well, why doesn't everybody get that? You know, that goes back to our earlier discussion. Again, we don't truly know, but there are some people who somehow can tap into. And then again, that brings us to, you know, predestiny. Does that mean that all of our lives is set in stone, that there's a predestination of a roadmap, if you like, of our lives that we can't get out of? That's an interesting one as well.
That's an interesting thing, isn't it? And here I am jumping in again. Sorry for that. Because in those cases where we've had cases of people not going to work, for example, because they had a bad feeling or a dream about 9/11, then that shows that there is another version of destiny. There's a version of destiny in which that person might die in the Twin Towers, and something alerts them to it so that they don't go.
Yeah, there is a mechanism there for sure, Howard, and wouldn't it be great if we all could have that? But then again, some people may have premonitions that they go in an aircraft and it's going to crash, and it doesn't crash, you know, so it can work both ways. Maybe they see it in their mind's eye. I dealt with a case in Glasgow some years ago. This psychic who was well known to me, and she was very, very good. Malcolm, there's going to be a bank robbery, and she named the bank. I won't say it on here. And I see it as clear as day. It's going to happen. There are going to be people. It's going to be shot, etc. So I was in this position where, what do I do about this? You know, so long story short, I notified the police. I tried to explain as best I could that I was a paranormal researcher. I worked with psychics, and we had this psychic who had this vision that this bank was going to be robbed. And I says, I would be remiss of me not to at least bring this to your attention. If nothing happens, then fine. But please, can you do something about it? So long story short, what happened was nothing happened, i.e. there were no bank robbery on that day at that time. So what's happening there? Was that predestiny that didn't happen? Was the very fact that I notified the police, etc., stop something from happening? We can only speculate. But so it doesn't always happen, premonitions, that is.
I have to say, and I think I might have told this once before, the night or maybe two nights before 9/11, I had a very clear dream, which I've never had before or since, of a silver jet passenger airliner sliding from the sky. And of course, that is precisely what happened in a field in Pennsylvania on that terrible day.
Yes.
So maybe I was, along with many other people who saw something like that in a dream, maybe that was a precognitive dream. And that's part of the fascination of everything that you and I both do, I think.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we should take care. I mean, dreams, of course, is just a jumble of the days, the weeks, events, and a potpourri of a whole range of things. But sometimes people do see into the future in dreams. So it's an interesting concept. People talk about keeping a dream diary. It's not something I've done, but clearly there may be some stock in that. But it's like what we call woman's intuition. Some women get this gut feeling that something is not right, you know. And there's so, so many. You can get books, untold books on this subject, which are out there. But, I mean, another interesting story that I feature in this book is, would you believe, a demon?
Mm.
So what happened there was one of our psychics, a lovely guy called Stephen Bird, and he comes along to SBI Investigations. And I believe him with my life, you know. I put my life on this guy. So it was the story I'm about to tell you happened just about the first lockdown. So that would be 2020. He was taking a walk down by the River Forth, and that's near Stirling in central Scotland. And he was conversing with his spirit family and his friends, as he does. You know, he's a very good psychic. He's idly talking away when suddenly he claims that his guardian angel said, you better be careful, something evil is about to happen. And he knew straight away, Howard, that if that was told to him, he better beware, you know. Then he looked towards this big, long hedge, which was about 40, 50 yards away. And it sounds preposterous, but, you know, the subject is preposterous. Suddenly he saw it was like a vortex, a whirlpool of energy appear just in front of this hedge. And stepping out of it was what he could only describe as like a devil, this horrible entity. And he said he likened it to the Tasmanian devil. It was like that kid's cartoon you got back in the 1970s or 80s. Those of an age should remember this. Similar to that. And it came rushing out towards him. So what he did was he put this protective bubble around him, you know, this white cone of light, and saying that, you know, nothing's going to harm me. Then suddenly this devil more or less stopped in its tracks and just melted away. Now, again, it sounds crazy. It sounds a ridiculous story. But like I say, I would put my life in this guy. He's true as the day is long. And he's a wonderful, wonderful psychic who's bringing a lot of comfort to people who have lost their loved ones. In point of fact, we're doing a presentation in the small town of Sauchie near Alloa in October, where he'll be doing platform clairvoyance. And I'll be giving a talk about ghosts and poltergeists.
We haven't talked just finally about UFOs, but that's something that you've been very heavily involved in. The events, of course, around Bonnie Bridge, which is said to be one of the most UFO-visited places in the United Kingdom, all kinds of cases in Scotland and across the world of UFOs, very much in the news at the moment. Is there anything ufological in the book?
You've got me on the spot with that one. I don't actually think there is, you know.
I don't think there is. But, you know, you've done an awful lot on that stuff. And just, if you wouldn't mind, a quick thought, if you have one, about where we stand with these investigations that are going on, the hearings in Washington, David Grush, and all of that material. Just really a thought between you and me of, did you ever believe that we would get to the stage where people are now seriously talking about so-called disclosure?
I didn't. I most certainly didn't. It's just so pleasing for me and my colleagues at SPI that we're now getting these congressional hearings in America. We know we've seen this fantastic footage taken by Navy pilots from the USS Nimitz, the USS Theodore Roosevelt. These, they call them the Tic Tac, Gimbal and Go Fast, these objects they gave the nickname to. I mean, if this is our own technology, wow, you know, why are we not exploiting it? Why is it under wraps? Is it the Chinese? Is it the Russians? I mean, they're talking about this big style now for the first time in a long, long time. The last time this happened was back in 2001 at the press club in America, where you had all these generals, Army, Navy, Air Force, all the medals, all the jackets. And I went, yes, at last, they're now going to tell the stories from the Army and the Navy, what they've experienced, but it was yesterday's news. Move on to, obviously, today and 2023, we've got the congressional hearings. I think it's getting closer. There's clearly something amiss here. I did not expect we would get something as close as this about 10 years ago. And I've always felt, Howard, I've always felt that the governments of this world know far, far more than they're letting on. Absolutely, you know. You look at some of these Freedom of Information Act files coming back, a lot of it's heavily censored. So there is something going on for sure.
I think so. I think the whole issue is going to run out of steam to an extent if the people who keep emailing me saying, yes, it's all very well that we have these hearings, but we want finally to see the proof. We want the pictures of the real aliens. We want to see some of the recovered material. I think if people are not given that, then some people will lose engagement with this issue.
I totally agree. I mean, I said that on another radio broadcast about what I thought about the David Grush, and I says, well, yeah, he's singing a good song, but we need the evidence. He's telling that he's spoken to people, that's seen various debris, various aliens, call them what you will. That's fine. But, we do need that evidence, because until we get that, it's a lovely, lovely story. And I'm the same, Howard. We need sorely to see this evidence.
I think it needs to go beyond you know, some videos of things that pilots have seen, which are astonishing, and they've been very brave to talk about this. But, you know, we need material beyond that now. Otherwise, some people will not connect with this issue, and an opportunity will be lost, I think. Back to the book. It's Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain, Volume 4, published by Flying Disc Press. Philip Mantle, again. A great book. Is it out at the moment, or is it coming out?
Yeah, it was officially released on the 1st of August there, yes.
All right. Well, Malcolm, I look forward to seeing you on the cruise in October. And we'll give full details. And you and I both know the details of all the great speakers, including yourself, on that and the things they'll be talking about. And also the amazing places that we're going to be going to. Malcolm, thank you very much indeed again.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Howard.
The great Malcolm Robinson. The book is Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain, Volume 4, published by Philip Mantle's Flying Disc Press. And fine organization that is. Please check out their many, many titles. Okay, more great guests in the pipeline here at the Home of the Unexplained coming soon. Don't forget, also coming soon, full details of the Unexplained Live 2, the cruise with Morella that is going to be in October. I will be able to tell you everything about it very, very soon, both in a podcast, and there will be links to a special micro website that will give you all of the details and will be a handy point of reference. Thank you very much for being part of this. Until next we meet here on the Home of the Unexplained, please stay safe, please stay calm, and please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.